This episode of No Wrong Answers is brought to you by Teach for America Kansas City, which believes teachers deserve to be celebrated and their voices elevated. Find out how you can join their movement of passionate educators in the Kansas City area by going to teachforamerica.org or find them on Twitter at @TFA_KC and on Instagram at @TFAKC.
Donald Trump takes office.
Americans want great schools for their children, safe neighborhoods for their families, and good jobs for themselves.
Protesters take to the streets.
Trump has got to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho!
And Betsy DeVos takes her case to Capitol Hill.
The law must be followed. Federal law must be followed where federal dollars are in play.
So were you unaware when I just asked you about the IDEA that it was a federal law?
I may have confused it.
Hear what our teachers think about these big stories, plus the legacy of Barack Obama on schools and school children on this inaugural episode of the No Wrong Answers podcast. And welcome to episode one of No Wrong Answers, the podcast that has real teachers hash out the big stories of the day and their impact on the classroom. I'm your host, Kyle Palmer. And I meant it when I said this was the inaugural episode. Trump is now in office. The streets are filled with protest in cities around the country. Betsy DeVos is under consideration to be our next Secretary of Education, and President Barack Obama exits the stage, leaving what many see as a complicated legacy for schools. Clearly, we have a lot to talk about, so let's introduce the teachers who are with us on this first episode. Princeton Grayson, what do you teach?
Princeton Grayson, Middle School Advanced Academics and Gifted and Talented.
Maddie Burkemper, what do you teach?
I teach fourth grade.
All of it.
That's
what you do in fourth grade.
I know.
And Rebecca McIntosh, what do you teach?
I teach a non-traditional classroom at the alternative school, kindergarten through fifth grade.
Well, thanks so much for being here. Glad that you could join us on our first episode. Let's get right to it. We have a lot to talk about, a lot of things affecting the classroom this week. Donald J. Trump was recently sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. A day later, hundreds of thousands of people were out in cities across the country protesting. These events might give some teachers whiplash. What do you tell your kids this week? Do you bring these outside events into your classroom? Can you stop them from coming in? Let's start with the actual inauguration for the teachers at the table. What was Inauguration Day like at your schools? Were there assemblies? Was there discussion about how to handle the event? What was it like?
Inauguration Day at my school was very much business as usual. We stayed on routine. We followed our own schedule. We talked about what was happening in Washington. We talked about the importance to our country. We talked about the process. We looked at some videos in the afternoon about what had happened, the parade videos, things like that. We did not stop and gather as a building. We acknowledged it was happening, but by and large, we stayed on our routines and did what we do on a Friday.
Yeah, I will say there were reports. I read an article in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution about how teachers and principals were actually fretting over whether to show the inauguration. There was a story about one Michigan teacher who created a brief furor over his decision to not show the inauguration. He sent a letter home to parents, which angered some of the parents. Was there both Friday and before a kind of tension on your campuses, a kind of discussion going on outside the classroom among faculty about feelings and political leanings one way or the other?
I can remember specifically some of the high school students, some of the older students who are paying much more close attention to it than my elementary kids are. Let's be honest about that. But I can remember conversations in the cafeteria or in the hallways or common areas about Trump won. You know, we're done with that Obama. We don't have to, things are going to get done now. That sort of thing.
My situation is different from yours in that anything that students have said in fourth grade, at least, is them regurgitating what their parents are saying to them at home.
What are some of the things that they're reciting, though? I'm interested because we often have this conversation that we know that hate is not something that you're born with. It's something that
right.
you're definitely trained
right.
in. and instilled into you. So I'm interested, what are some of the things that they're saying?
My kids talk a lot about building the wall. They've picked
Mine
up
too.
On that language about there's going to be a wall. They repeat the sentences word for word.
Or a lot of referencing of deportation. I
right.
hope that you get deported. I hope that you get deported. I wish that you were Mexican so you could be deported.
And these are students saying this to other students.
Yes. Yeah. But even then, in mine, there's the outside perception that my classroom is experiencing the Trump effect to a large degree, but in actuality, my experience has been business as usual with very isolated instances of a student saying one inflammatory remark that they truly don't understand. I'll have a conversation with them afterwards, and I can't describe the immediacy of me saying, do you know the weight of that comment? And my fourth grade student looking back at me and saying, no, I just wanted to prove my point. Or
it's almost like it's entered the arsenal of what students might
like,
say.
You're dumb.
For,
like
yeah,
you're,
right,
like
right.
Your feet smell. Like you're a butthead. I wish you were deported.
And that's
disturbing.
But, yeah. Well, I mean, you mentioned the Trump effect. I will say, just to give context to listeners, that it was a term coined by the Southern Poverty Law Center. They did a report actually during the campaign before the election. Their report was based on an admittedly unscientific survey of 2,000-some teachers, and they noted this kind of increase in bullying and harassment reported by these teachers, intimidation of students, especially students of color and minorities, and also growing tension between not just students but also between colleagues as well. Let's really quickly, since the inauguration just happened, let's play a very brief clip of Trump's inaugural address. He did not dwell on education much, which is not necessarily a surprise for an inaugural address, but he did, in his own way, mention schools.
But for too many of our citizens, a different reality exists. Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities, rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation. An education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge.
So I will say a quick bit of fact checking. The line that stands out for educators, of course, education system flush with cash. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities says that since 2014, well, in 2014, actually, 35 states were providing less aid to schools than they were in 2008. Do you guys feel flush with cash?
I would very much like to see these buildings that are flush with cash. I would like to flush this viewpoint. I'm sorry.
But just to push, I mean, just a little bit, right? Because that message has resonated with a significant portion of our population. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine with a significant portion of students that you either teach or their families, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, or you can tell me your experiences. But, you know, with that vision, what do you see in your class?
And I will push back a little bit on that one, Kyle, because people, and the research will back up, people think their local school is doing a great job. And that's been true for 20 years, since pre-No Child Left Behind programs were in place. People think their local schools do a good job, but they take the viewpoint everybody else is not doing as well.
Princeton, do you kind of see this us, them, mine, our language in the speech and in the rhetoric?
Yeah, definitely. When I'm just floored sometimes when I hear Donald Trump speak, but when I hear like education is flush with cash, I think of people like Betty DeVos, who's making money off of broken education.
Who we'll get to in just a second, yeah.
But to that point, like, I just think that there are some pockets where I can definitely see this being a reality, that there are some people benefiting in very inappropriate ways off of a broken educational system, and they are making money off the backs of our children. Is that the traditional public schools? Oftentimes, no, it's not, because there is such a bureaucracy around the way that we manage our funds and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we must say, I mean, the day after the inauguration, hundreds of thousands of people across the country, including here in Kansas City where the show is taped, went out into the streets in protest. The New York Times said the estimates in all the different cities easily topped 1 million people nationwide. As educators, what do you see your role in such a political climate? What obligations do you feel inside the classroom?
For me, education, teaching has always been a very political act, because I serve students who have been intentionally underserved for so long in our country. And so I've always considered my role to be very political. While my classroom is not politicized, my role is. And so, I mean, the fact that it is a part of a presidential speech indicates that it's obviously a political topic. And so for me, it makes me want to be even more engaged civically. It also provides opportunities to challenge our students to show their potential impact if they get civically engaged, and that you don't have to wait to become a quote-unquote adult to make a difference. And also to really bring in those facts and to not allow our students to continue to perpetuate falsehoods or alternative facts, as the new term of the day. And so I think it's our jobs as teachers to, one, not shy away from having real conversations about real topics that affect our kids, but also to be equipped with the accuracy and the facts that helps us move the conversation forward.
Alternative facts, referencing a comment made by Trump spokesperson Kellyanne Conway on Meet the Press.
And if I could make one more, more thought I thought of as Princeton we're talking. And I think we're obligated as instructors to educate people, patrons, community, coworkers, on the impact that whatever plan comes, and we don't know what the plan is. We've heard no plan. On his website for the past 2 years, it's been Common Core bad, vouchers good. So we just don't know what to expect. But I think we are absolutely obligated to be sure whatever plan does come, that we share the impact that's going to have on our students with special needs, on our gifted and talented programs, on our career and technical education programs, on those, what the impact will be.
Maddie Birkenberg, do you, throughout this conversation, and as you know, you've been reflecting on the election and now the inauguration and the political nature of that, do you feel more discouraged or emboldened by what's been happening?
I feel a strong mixture of both. I think that the events have really discouraged me. I've been met with a lot of surprise, like walking into my school building the day after the election, thinking that, you know, my feelings of fear and sadness and shock, that I was, you know, going to be met with a community that shared all of those. It was discouraging to realize that that we're not a monolith at my school, that there are people who do share my point of view and that there are people that I work with that don't, and coming to terms with that. And then
may I ask, why is that so hard to come to terms with for
Well,
you?
When we have buildings, like building discussions as a staff, and people make statements, like generalized statements, like we need to do what's best for our kids, and knowing that my view of our kids is different maybe from colleagues that I work with when they say our kids, that feeling got mirrored in Trump's inauguration speech when he said a lot of like us and then comments, like this is your America, you will never be ignored again. When I listened to the inauguration speech after school, I didn't feel like he was speaking to me once. I didn't feel like he was speaking to my students. I didn't feel like he was speaking to my school district. And realizing that he is speaking to some of my colleagues, and that when some of my colleagues hear Donald Trump make those statements of you will not be ignored, or your children in the school system will be supported by me, and realizing that there's this disconnect of,
I was not surprised by that at all. I mean,
I'm surprised by?
By the fact that we have
that divide there?
Yeah.
Within the teaching community.
Within the teaching community, definitely, because we look at the statistics here, like even just on paper, that majority of our teachers are white women. Trump had a significant support of white women. So it makes a lot of sense that that there will be some overlap there. There will be significant overlap there. So I'm not surprised
that the NEA went pro-Trump.
Not the
NEA, like,
but
officially, but that their
definitely.
Membership voted.
As an NEA leader, let me go ahead and address that.
For him.
The National Education Association endorsed
Hillary
Clinton, Secretary Clinton, very early in the process, and that was a huge issue for our members.
As was we the AFT. Are,
as for AFT, we have, you know, 3.2 million members, certainly not a monolith. There was that many members that felt we should have had a longer conversation about that, and the effort was to get involved earlier.
Yeah.
Post-election, we found up to almost a third of our voting members did vote for the Republican candidate. it's a huge lesson to us in that we did not communicate what we needed to communicate about the impact on education. So that's a whole learning piece for the NEA to do. But I think it's as Princeton referenced, knowing that we are not a one-issue population is always surprising to me as an educator and as a union leader, because it is my issue, and I forget that it's not everyone's
I think
issue.
That the election was me realizing that I had the blind spot that you are talking about.
That's a good way to say it.
And I think that that's why I'm so disturbed with what's happening, and also with what's happening in my own, the way that I'm realizing I react to society, the way that I react to my students, because I didn't realize I had that blind spot. That leaves me feeling really discouraged about my prior actions and my inaction, and it leaves me hopeful.
Prior actions in what regard? What do you mean?
How I don't suffer consequences for not following a deadlines and thinking back to those specific instances and realizing it's because I'm white, middle class, female, and I have escaped consequences because of my place in society, because of my
Grips with our privilege.
Coming to grips
right,
with my
you.
Privilege.
Saying, we can't avoid this word privilege here. We need
the word
to go
we're looking for
it.
Is privilege.
Well, and that's the thing. And filling in those gaps for myself and learning how to support my students in an authentic way, in a way that actually matters, and learning when, not out of lack of wanting, but just knowing that I need to ask, how does one do that? How does one begin to do that? And realizing a lot of it is listening. A lot of it is asking questions, and a lot of it is feeling comfortable saying to the world, I honestly don't know. Like, I honestly didn't know that blind spot was there, and I want to know about it. Please tell me more about other blind spots that I have. I want to support you.
It sounds like you are opening yourself up to the possibility of being more vulnerable as a person and as an educator.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah. Which Princeton. I definitely think is commendable. And I think to the point around the Trump effect, I think that's part of the Trump effect, that it's not just this negative piece, but there's also been this increase in conversations and awareness that we didn't have before, or there was not as much of an urgency
teachers.
Around it.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, well, we were already getting to a space, I think, in education, particularly urban education, where social justice became a significant priority, which required conversations about race and class and economics in ways that we hadn't had in the past, whereas Trump has definitely created a greater sense of urgency around those conversations, especially because Maddie represents the demographic that is the primary demographic of all of our teachers.
And that's true. I go to school feeling urgent. I go to school every single day feeling urgent and like this is huge.
Which definitely excites me, because I feel like I was born into a world feeling urgent. And so now that I feel like I have colleagues and counterparts who are feeling that same urgency, it gives me hope for the changes that could potentially come.
Oh. Yeah. And now that I'm beginning to better understand what that urgency does feel like, I feel like I'm in a position to then talk to my colleagues and say, listen, I know that when you say we need to do what's best for our kids, I 100% believe that you mean that in a good way. However, your actions aren't supporting that truly for all of our kids. Let's work together. Let's talk about this so that when we come to school tomorrow, we can have a more authentic understanding of who are our kids, what does need to be done for our kids. You like widen your lens, look around, look at the carpet on your classroom, and let's really ask ourselves, how are you supporting our students? And that needs to be an inclusive term. Our students should not mean your future child from your same background. Our students is the collective, you know?
Well, we'll leave it there. This topic clearly worthy of discussion. Let's throw it out to the teachers listening out there. How have you been impacted by the election and the inauguration? In what ways are you seeing the Trump effect play out in your school, in your classroom? You can leave a comment at our Facebook page or tweet at us. Find us at No Wrong Answers Podcast. Our podcast today is sponsored by Teach for America Kansas City, which believes one day all children will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. You can make an immediate impact on that mission in Kansas City. To find out how, visit teachforamerica.org or find us on Twitter at @TFA_KC or on Instagram at @TFAKC. Well, it's rare that education news bubbles up enough to make national headlines and capture the attention of non-educators. One of those times was recently when billionaire investor, philanthropist, and I guess we can call her education activist, Betsy DeVos, had her confirmation hearing to be Donald Trump's Secretary of Education before a Senate committee. There were several moments in the hearing that drew attention. Maybe for non-educators, the most viral moment was this exchange with Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy on allowing guns in school.
The underlying question is...
You can't say definitively today that guns shouldn't be in schools?
Well, I will refer back to Senator Enzi, and he was talking about in Wapiti, Wyoming. I think probably there, I would imagine that there's probably a gun in the school to protect from potential grizzlies.
Hashtag grizzly bears. We should say Pulitzer Prize-winning website PolitiFact has since rated that statement by Betsy DeVos false. They actually called the school district in Wapiti, Wyoming, that DeVos cited. The superintendent there said that the district has a strict no-weapons policy in their schools. At another moment in the hearing, DeVos seemed confused over what the federal IDEA law was. You heard that at the beginning of the show. That's the law, of course, that requires students with disabilities be given a free and appropriate education. We should say at the time of this taping, the Senate has actually delayed taking a vote on DeVos by a week to January 31st. Education Week actually reports that the delay announcement came a day after DeVos filed financial disclosure statements. That's another layer to this. Many Democrats were worried about some financial conflicts of interest she may have along with her husband. Still, Republicans cited in that Education Week article say her confirmation is not in jeopardy. So many non-educators were fascinated by the spectacle of all this. But as people who know education and live, work, and breathe it, I mean, I want to know what you're thinking and what you're feeling.
It's
Rebecca.
I'll go. It's a thank you, Kyle. It's surreal that a woman who has never attended, worked in, or taught in a public school is about to be in charge of the public schools in
our
country.
But is that necessary?
I'm all about an outsider idea. I am fine with outside ideas. Let's bring them in. Let's talk about them. But what appears to be just a willful ignorance, an avoidance of fact, a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of public schools in the United States, is deeply, deeply troubling.
Princeton
and
Grayson.
A huge slap it's a slap in the face.
And it's not even just the fact that she didn't attend, teach, or work in a public school. Neither did her children. But it's also that she's actively worked against public education in any effective ways in Michigan. And I know that her husband serves and leads charter school boards within Michigan. But if you look at even some of their data points, their academic data points, they are underperforming the state standards. And so
I will say, just to butt in, I mean, Politico has called Betsy DeVos a, quote, aggressive advocate for the expansion of charter schools. You're referencing her advocacy work in the state of Michigan where she's from.
Exactly. And so to Rebecca's point, it's very alarming and surreal to see someone be nominated for an office that she does not have the requisite experience to uphold, especially when we're talking about education, because to me, that's the equivalent of a superintendent never going to college. Like, how do you put someone in a position where they're supposed to be at the helm to show others the way when we're not even sure that's something she believes in?
Asking from outside the sphere of education, give me a sense of why her prior advocacy for programs like the expansion of charter schools and certainly school vouchers as well, why that bothers you, why as public school teachers that would have a direct impact or bearing on your work in your schools.
Ms. DeVos's approach to that charter expansion, to her work on behalf of vouchers, has been a free market kind of approach. Cherry pick the best students, set them up, make as much profit. It's a profit-motivated model. You see that in Michigan. You see it in Louisiana. You see it in Ohio. And we've got data that shows their students are not succeeding. They're making money, but they're not they're not helping students. You can look at charter schools, voucher systems in Boston, in New York, in New Orleans, that are successful. Hmm. So it's the profit motivation rather than the success motivation that's fundamentally offensive to me.
It's the idea that you can hand a family a voucher ticket to go, and then once they have that ticket, that means they will be able to find a better performing school in their area that could support their student who may or may not have disabilities. But that singular voucher does not ensure that your student will then end up at a building that has the facilities and has the qualifications in order for them to be successful. And that's what I'm okay with having a conversation about vouchers. I'm okay one day supporting a voucher system. It's that one voucher doesn't ensure, it doesn't equal.
Guarantee.
Thank you. That the voucher does not guarantee that your student will then end up at a building that will help them be successful.
And so to that point, I feel like what my hesitation around her approach to education, public education, is that I don't feel like it accounts for those who are already being traditionally underserved. And so when I hear her speak about it in this free market era, and I know that she's a very religious person, I hear her saying basically she wants to be able to leverage these vouchers in a way that allows more affluent families to not have to pay for their education anymore and use this voucher system to subsidize their own education, which leaves a complete a large demographic of our current public education students out of a conversation and out of access. So when I hear about this school choice, I just feel like it is not, I haven't heard it in a way that assures me that the families in which I currently serve and choose to serve are included in the conversation.
And I appreciate that you said the word subsidize, because I think a lot of public perception is that the voucher is your future tuition. But even still, you could be a student where your public school is pretty decent and there are several private religiously affiliated schools around you, but that voucher, there's still a gap between the voucher and the tuition cost. So even then, the vouchers aren't going to touch that underserved community at all.
Final question. We didn't play a clip of tape from this part of the hearing, at least not in this segment, but there was a point where DeVos seemed to not understand the federal IDEA law, which requires all public schools provide free and appropriate education. I hear some groans already. And she actually said it should be left up to the states on whether to enforce that federal law. I wonder, I'm already getting reactions, but this, for educators, I think this particular moment was even, you know, more emotion-laden and, I think, divisive than the grizzly bear moment for non-educators.
I feel like you should.
The grizzly bear moment is common relief for what was a painful, painful hearing. But the fundamental ignorance about the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESSA, Every Student Succeeds,
which was passed by the Obama administration,
is in place, and she will be responsible for enforcing until there is a new one. IDEA, the Students with Disabilities Act, any number of dozens of federal programs that she will have the responsibility to enforce is just, I go back to the word fundamental. It's just a fundamental misunderstanding and ignorance of
Give me a sense,
the responsibility of the job.
All three of you are public school teachers. All three of you, I bet, have significant numbers of students in your class that have IEPs, individual education plans, are being served for special education needs. I guess, what does a sentiment like that mean for those students, in your opinion?
If the schools don't have the programs needed to serve a student with disabilities, okay, so your mom, you have a student with a disability, you're sending them to school. Betsy takes away and does not enforce these federal regulations requiring the schools in your area to have programs that would support your kid. You, as a mother, may or may not be able to move with your child to a school that does have those programs. So when those regulations aren't enforced, those services are often the most expensive ones within your school budget. So when they don't have the programs to support kids with disabilities, you don't have a school in your area to send your child who does have a disability. You're given a voucher and you're told, we'll send your student wherever you want to then.
If they're even accepted.
If they're accepted, if you can get through the lottery system, if you can drive that far in between your work shifts,
if the staff is qualified to teach them.
If you can afford to move. So those families who have low mobility need a school to send their kids to. And when they're not required to have those services from the government, their options disappear.
Well, teachers, parents out there, what do you think? Does what Betsy DeVos said in her hearing disqualify her from being Secretary of Education? Why or why not? Go to our Facebook page, send us a tweet, find us at No Wrong Answers Podcast. Moving on, the final topic we have before our Kids These Days segment ends it all out. Barack Obama is now no longer president. Last check, he was vacationing in California somewhere, but he will be back. Both him and his wife, Michelle, have made clear that they will be on the scene publicly in some sort of role. And you can already see that the Obama Foundation has launched at obama.org. What is his legacy for schools and school children? And I leave that question intentionally broad right now. What's his legacy?
Well,
Rebecca.
President Obama, and I'm no fan of Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, but I will give them credit.
Who was his long-serving education, no longer Secretary of Education, and at the end of Obama's term, it was John King.
Correct.
But yeah, for most of Obama's term.
For most of the term and for most of the changes in policy, Secretary Duncan and President Obama pulled us out of the No Child Left Behind testing mania. I will give them partial credit on the assignment for that. I think they took us in a very dangerous place with Race to the Top that was not good for many, many
schools. In what ways?
Why was it dangerous in your opinion? The formulation that public education is a race, mm-hmm. That you have to be better than another one to get the bigger piece of the pie financially.
And we should say, I mean, Race to the Top kind of incentivized.
Race to the Top, you know, the competitive grants,
States had to implement the Common Core, increase the use of charter schools, do teacher evaluations tied to test scores in order to get federal money.
Right. Some would argue that Race to the Top was No Child Left Behind 2.0 because of the incentivized pieces that if you want our money, you got to do it our way, which is actually part of the argument with Trump. And
I would agree
exactly.
with that.
And having said all of those things, I don't know that those were positive overall long-term things. Having said all that, President Obama's legacy as far as social justice issues, the policies and executive orders he signed for LGBTQ students, for Title IX students, for students with disabilities, for bringing attention to the school-to-prison pipeline, things that we are talking about now that we were not talking about 8 years ago, I think are significant and will be long-lasting. I think they go back to starting that conversation that Princeton talked about earlier, that we have to talk about those things now in our classrooms. We have to address those as factors in our schoolhouses.
Yeah.
And we weren't talking about that 8 years ago.
And even teachers, in at the broader scope, I think, one, he provided an example of what Black excellence can look like without you being an athlete or an entertainer, which was great as an educator. That's something I always look forward to, find examples of excellence outside of entertainment.
Can you dig into that just a little bit more? I mean, what does that look like on the ground in the classroom?
On the ground in the class, I mean, it provides, so he provided a lot of opportunities to have real conversations. So when we have like the Trayvon Martin moment, and where he comes on and says, that could have been my son, that provided opportunities for us to really have serious conversations, and then also catapult that into, if Barack Obama can ascend to such an office that has never been done before, and he's not an entertainer, and he's gotten a degree, he's went to Harvard, he's done all these excellent things, then it provides students with more hope that this is not my only avenue out. And it also gives teachers more of a window to show students that this is not your only way out either. Mm-hmm. So for me, as a Black male teacher, it provided a lot of confidence and a lot of reinforcement, positive reinforcement that this is possible for our kids, and that we have something to strive toward without it simply being an entertainer.
Maddie Burkemper.
I resonate with that a lot, especially as a fourth grade teacher. Part of our curriculum in social studies is learning and talking about early government in the United States. We talk a lot about slavery in the United States and how society was structured. And it's like every single time when we've talked about slavery in my classroom, kids have brought up Obama and have gone, well, how can he be president now then? Or how could slavery have even existed when our president is a Black man? Did that come out? Did that make sense?
It did make sense. Now, I will say, though, there's like this caveat that, and when I talk about real conversations, that Obama largely was very symbolic and just symbolism. Did it actually change as much on the ground as we would have hoped? And I think people thought, as in like, when I think of reflect on the 2008 moment where it's announced that he won the election, I think people thought there was going to be like this light switch
like
turn on
wave.
Moment. And that was definitely not the case. But it does provide a lot of opportunities to push into, and it provides a lot of optimism of what could be if we had more people working toward that.
It gives you a place to go in that conversation that previously we did not have, and you taught that lesson and there you ended it. Now you can see that arc bending, and you have more to talk about, and you can draw a line, you know, through some different things.
Yeah.
And so it gives you, it's not closure. It's not a final conversation.
Well, and it forces us to talk about.
But it gives you a next step to talk about.
It's positive, but it also forces me as an educator to talk about with my class. You know, the kids always do say, well, slavery has ended. And I'm like, yes, but you're still experiencing waves of that currently.
Oh, to our listeners, one last time, what do you think is Barack Obama's legacy in our schools and school children? Leave a comment at our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet as well. Find us at No Wrong Answers Podcast. Well, our final segment will be this. Kids these days. Teachers, believe it or not, are some of the hippest, trendiest, most in-the-know people in the world. Why? Because they hang out all day with the true tastemakers of our popular culture, preteens. So each week, we'll ask each of our teachers, what are the kids into these days? Just to give us an insight into their daily lives and maybe possibly, I don't know, get a recommendation from some fourth graders, at least in Maddie's and Rebecca's case. But Princeton, start us off. What are your kids into these days?
Well, let me first say, I don't know if I would consider myself hanging out with them all day.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I don't know it.
That's not the message we want people to get from this.
Imagine people imagining us in the studio right now, like we're all super on trend and...
That too.
I don't know.
With my kids right now, so there's this there's a social media issue going on right now between Chris Brown and Soulja Boy. And so there's
Soulja Boy still around.
He's come back from wherever he was. But they're beefing right now on social media. Well, they were in the last couple weeks, and it's created opportunities. So right now kids are really into social media. Going live is the thing right now. So between Snapchat and Facebook Live, so I say that's connected to the Soulja Boy and Chris Brown. Soulja Boy went live on one of his accounts. And Soulja Boy is good with the hood was one of his taglines. And he ends up getting into some altercation with one of the community members. And so a lot of our kids are just reenacting that throughout the hallways and in the classroom. So they'll come in that so-and-so is good with the hood, and then someone like push him away because that's what happened on Soulja Boy's live feed. So that's kind of what they're doing right now, just imitating celebrities on social media.
Wait, what's the beef between...
We're really going to get into the weeds here, guys.
Well,
Macintosh has no idea what you just said.
Some Twitter comment between a girl that Chris Brown used to date and Soulja Boy, I think, is trying to date. And yeah,
Maddie, what are your kids into these days?
The poop emoji. I hate it.
You hate it, but
I hate it so much.
You have to put more context on that.
It is on everything. And it started at the beginning of the year. One of my students on the back of her backpack has this, trying to give a visual, like a fist-sized plush poop emoji. It even has feet on it. It's not even...
So this is a physical object.
Yeah, they're personifying poop. They put feet on it, eyes are on it, and it's on her backpack. So she wore that to school one day. I was like, oh, how's your weekend? She's like, oh my gosh, best ever. I got this new keychain, you know, and I didn't, usually I limit my reaction, you know, because the more the kids know what annoys you, the more you see that everywhere you go. And it just happened. I went, ugh, and like made a really gross face and was loud and... So all the kids know that I don't find poop funny or want to personify it or touch it.
And so now the poop emoji is appearing on everything now.
Leggings, keychains, people have worn a few shirts. I've seen earrings. I'll be talking to a student and be like, oh, Miss B, will you hold this for me for a second? And I'll say, sure, I won't look. I'll pick it up. I'm holding the poop keychain. And then I'll go, ugh, and it's everywhere. It's even on, we had an assembly the other day, and these people came in and were like, the more pamphlets you sell, the more keychains you get.
It was like a fundraiser,
Yeah, guess what the free keychain item is?
A poop emoji?
It's a poop emoji. So now they're like, we got to sell all the major
saver coupons.
So now
this is school sanctioned now. Okay.
Yeah, well, it's Rebecca, disgusting.
Rebecca, what are your kids into these days?
I'm the biggest dork at the table. That's all I can say. My group of kids, grade level, K through five.
Yeah.
They've just recently, and I think it trickled down from my bigger ones, they've all created YouTube channels. They're all YouTubing themselves.
Oh, okay.
And I know YouTube is not new, but it's new for my group. And
so they all have their own personal channels.
They will come in and say that's what they did the night before, and then they're following each other in the evening. And
what do they do on their channels?
Nonsense. They get on and perform and show their Hatchimals. Hatchimals are very big right now, the animals that will grow and you have to take care of them. So it's their own personal TV station. This is new to them now.
And they kind of like a talk
wildly
show.
Wildly entertainment
almost.
To me, but deeply disturbing at the same time.
I have a kid with a YouTube channel.
It's frightening. I'm checking them just because I know they're going to talk about me eventually, but I don't want to find it when they
do. Oh, well, kids these days.
I know,
we'll say,
kids these days.
Well, that will do it for this inaugural episode of No Wrong Answers. We will have our weekly extra credit segment drop on Wednesday, so look out for that. New full episodes drop every Monday. You can like us at Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Just search for the No Wrong Answers podcast by Fountain City Frequency. You can find us at iTunes. And once you find us, subscribe to the podcast. And this is important, leave us a review. It helps little startups like ours. There are no other podcasts like ours giving you a teacherly take on the world. If you've enjoyed this conversation you've heard, subscribe, leave us a review, and keep the conversation going. Thanks to our teachers this week, Princeton Grayson.
Thank you.
Maddie Burkemper.
Thanks.
And Rebecca McIntosh.
Always a good time. Thank you.
Thanks to Matt Hodapp, who produces the podcast. Again, thanks to our sponsor, Teach for America, Kansas City. I'm Kyle Palmer. And remember, kids, be nice to your teachers.